This is episode 37 of The Living Reminders with Mary and Blake. From Providence, Rhode Island, this is The Living Reminders. We're a podcast dedicated to the show The Leftovers on HBO. We're still here, and so are you. So let's talk with Damon Lindelof. Suddenly I'm hidden. It's the darkness of the dawn. And your friends are gone. And your friends won't come. So show me where you fit. So show me where you fit. Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Mary Larson.
My name's Blake, and I can't believe what you're about to hear. I can't believe it. It's happened. It's here. We've done it, and a life's dream has been fulfilled.
I'm pretty excited.
Yeah,
I
know.
Excited,
right?
And I hope you, the listener, are very excited to go on this journey with us of speaking with the most VIP of VIPs, in my opinion.
I would suggest, I would at least argue that you're correct, that's a pretty VIP thing. And not to pat ourselves in the back here or whatever, and I don't want to do that. But what I do want to do is let you know that we got a lot of really good stuff out of Damon for this interview. And I'm really excited to get it out, especially in regards to what he says about season three that's coming up, the final season of The Leftovers. So, you know what? Why don't we stop wasting everybody's time? And let's just get to exactly what everyone wants to hear.
Joining us today is Damon Lindelof, a television writer, showrunner, producer, and film screenwriter whose work includes Crossing Jordan, Nash Bridges, Wasteland, Star Trek Into Darkness, World War Z, that movie was so scary, Cowboys and Aliens, Prometheus, Tomorrowland, and a little-known TV show called Lost. Some of you might have heard of it. Lindelof's writing has literally redefined how people not only watch TV, but how we discuss it as well, and has helped also give birth to this current golden age of television in which we find ourselves today. But we all know him as the co-creator and executive producer and showrunner of our favorite television show on HBO, The Leftovers. Damon, thank you so much for joining us on The Living Reminders today.
It is a pleasure. Thanks for taking all the amazing amount of time and energy that you've invested in the show. It's the least I could do. It is an honor to be here. I hope you guys are dressed in white and smoking cigarettes. I'm imagining you that way.
Damn it, he found us out.
First off, Damon, congrats on a fantastic season two of The Leftovers, which many people are calling one of television's best seasons ever.
I think that was my mom who said that.
More importantly, we are so incredibly happy that you're going to do a season three. So we just wanted to congratulate you on that, too. It's like, you know, the holiday gifts came early for you. I mean, people love your show and you get to have a season three. That's pretty great for you and for all of us.
Thanks. All this kindness is making it much harder for me to imagine you in your GR getup, though, I have to say. Like, you're a splinter group of the GR that just goes around saying nice things to people. It might be more effective, to be honest with you. But I'll take it. Thank you. On behalf of everybody who kills themselves to try to make the show special, thanks. It really is. People say it's a team effort all the time because that's what we're supposed to say, but I've never been in an environment more where the collaboration really was responsible for making something special. The show surprises me mostly because I get to receive your love, but there are so many others who are responsible for making Leftovers what it is, so I have to give them a huge shout out, and I will call them one by one when we finish this podcast to pass along your warm wishes.
You know, I know all the fans united in a lot of ways on social media and with hashtag Renew the Leftovers, and you know, gathering in New York in white and smoking and everything. I thought that was it was a really cool organic thing for the fans to do, and it's one of those things where I think people just really wanted to show their appreciation, even though it may be a small niche audience. They're really ardent fans.
No, and you know, as someone who has lobbied for bubble shows that are on the verge of cancellation to be picked up on multiple occasions over the years, it was hugely gratifying to be on the receiving end of that kind of love. I was actually flying to New York at the time that was happening, so my wife and I took off at 10 in the morning or something LA time, and then we landed at around 7 p.m. New York time. So it had all happened while we were in the air, and I was like, oh man, I wish I had flown out a day earlier, because I totally would have gone down and thanked them personally.
So going back a bit,
then HBO probably would have thought I was behind it.
maybe would have been a good or bad thing, I'm not sure. Going back a bit, how did you learn personally about The Leftovers? Like, what was your first experience with it, and what made you choose The Leftovers as your first show post Lost? Like, what specifically interested you?
A couple things sort of happened simultaneously, but and in the spirit of storytelling, the brain tends to reorganize events for maximum impact. But my memory of it is that the first, I've been a Tom Parada fan for quite some time, and whenever he writes a book, I read it. I was reading the New York Times book review, which I do so that I can pretend that I've read books that I actually haven't read. And Stephen King wrote a review of The Leftovers. Stephen King has had a huge, he's my favorite author. He's had a huge impact on me wanting to be a writer, and I just worship at the altar of him. And here he was writing a review of a Parada book, and he was describing it as the best episode of The Twilight Zone that had never been made. And so I read sort of like three paragraphs of the review, and then was starting to get into kind of spoiler territory, and I was like, I need to get this book immediately. This sounds amazing. It just sort of talked about the premise of the departure and everything else. And I just felt that flutter in my stomach that we feel when, you know, when we hear an idea that is captivating or exciting to us. And the next day I was flying to London, and I bought the book in the airport, and started reading it, and then passed that on the plane and slept the rest of the way. And then when I arrived in London, Michael Ellenberg, who was an executive at HBO, who I had worked on Prometheus with, he emailed me, "Have you read The Leftovers?" And so it felt like all these things were kind of starting to align in terms of you can always read the tea leaves any way you want, but the universe was sort of saying that this is going to be something special. And then I read the book over the course of the next 2 days, and I was deeply moved by it. And it was sort of about all the themes that I'm really interested in, and it told the story in a way that only Tom can, which was he scaled down this massive idea and it onto a very sort of small, intimate scale. And I'd been kind of binge watching Friday Night Lights and Parenthood, the kind of the Jason Kadam shows that I had missed over the six years that I was making Lost, and sort of like it just kind of hit the sweet spot. And so I emailed Ellenberg back, and I was like, "This is the most amazing thing ever." He said, "HBO owns it. Is it something you'd be interested in?" And the rest is history.
What is a typical day in the life of Damon when you're working on the show? So take me from beginning to the end. What is it like for you?
Oh, good God. I don't think there is any typical day on The Leftovers. It really works in phases in terms of depending on where we are in the year. The first part of designing a season of the show is probably the most fun that I have, where we just basically, there's a series of informal conversations between Tom Parada and I, and in this past season, Tom Spezialy, who came on as an executive producer as well before we actually sort of formally staffing the show. Jackie Hoyt, who was a writer, a producer, who was on season one, who was coming over from season two. So I would have these kind of informal conversations with them about some of the ideas that would become the building blocks of season two. But then we hired the staff, and we all got in a room together and started talking about what we were going to do. And that lasted for about 3 to 4 solid weeks of just pure world building, storytelling. What is the town of Jarden like? What's going to happen when Kevin and Nora and Joe and the baby arrive? How did Matt and Mary get there? Who are the Murphys? Why is there a guy walking around sacrificing goats? And interspersed in all those conversations, this guy, Reza Aslan, who wrote this amazing book called Zealot that I had read between the seasons. It turned out that he was a big fan of the first season of the show. And so we brought him in almost as sort of like our resident religious scholar. And we started talking about not just organized religion in terms of, Christianity and Islam and Judaism and Hinduism, but also these sort of more like the history of religion itself, proto-religion, how did religion start? He started talking about, the early indigenous peoples and cave paintings and spirit animals and all that kind of stuff. And so we really started at the literal beginning, and I was like, oh, we should do some of that. And so it all kind of swirled into this sort of amazing blender that resulted in the second season of the show. So a typical day during that period was we would get into the writer's room, around 10 in the morning and go until 6 at night, and then just go and get a really good night's sleep and then start it over. And so that's kind of like phase one. And then phase two is, once we've gotten approvals from HBO, then we start to bring in the production elements of the show. And so Mimi Leader, who is, every bit as much of a showrunner as I am, because she runs the show in Texas, and ran the show in New York for the back half of the first season, she gets folded into, okay, here's now what we want to do. How do we make this? How do we realize it? And then she and her team, Gene Kelly, we brought on this year, an amazing producer, and then John Pano, who is the production designer, who's responsible for really just the look of the show. Those were key hires for season two, and those three basically kind of went off, and it was their job to find and build Jarden, while we as writers started continuing the process of actually writing the scripts of the season. And through that, and then as we started to write, we had to start casting, and I had a meeting with Regina and knew instantly that I wanted her to be Erica, but we had a very talented casting director, Vicky Thomas, started bringing in choices for John and Michael and Evie, and so the casting wheel started up, and that started consuming a lot of time, and then the production wheel started up. So Mimi started doing show and tells as to like, here's what it would look like if Jarden was in Louisiana. Here's what it would look like if it was in northern Florida. Here's what it would look like if it was in Texas, they did a lot of location scouting and took a lot of photos. So now our days are starting to be consumed by not just the creative, but also the production. And then the next wheel is actually the writing. So now we start breaking the stories as writers, saying, here's what episode one is going to be. And we sit in the room and we talk at great length and detail of what that's going to be. And so that 10 to 6 period is still in the writer's room, but now prior to 10 and after 6, these other conversations are happening, revolving around the production of the show, and then I'm actually starting to write these scripts. Mm. I partner on every script of The Leftovers with one of the other writers, so we co-write these things. And so the writing started kind of absorbing my evenings. And then the actual production of the show starts in Texas. We actually start making the show, so now I start actually traveling down to Texas. I would go for 3 days every 2 weeks. So I'd spend one full week in LA, and then the following Wednesday, I would go down to Texas and stay there until Saturday, and then come back and repeat the process so that I could, you know, be available to Mimi and the actors. And then the way that the episodes are directed is I go down and I do this thing called toning the scripts, where I sit down with the director and we go from page one to page 55 or however many pages it is, and just talk about, like, here's what it is we're going for. This is the way that I envision this. I'm now available for you to ask questions. This is what the episode is thematically about. This is what the characters are experiencing, et cetera. And then the directors just go off and do their thing, because I'm not a set guy. I don't like to, breathe down anyone's neck. I surround myself with incredibly talented individuals, and then I let them do their work. And so we were enormously blessed this year to just have amazing directors on the show. And so I feel like kind of the less I was in Texas, the better. And so now the show is in production, and we're making it. And then once we wrap the first episode, now I start editing. And so now that's the final cog to sort of fall into place. And by then, an average day in my life kind of starts at, you know, me rolling into the office somewhere between 9 and 9:30 a.m. and most nights leaving at like 10 p.m. and then catching up with my wife and then went to work.
So one of the things that really piqued my interest when you were talking about it is a couple of things. First is picking your staff and then picking their directors. How do you pick your staff? Like you famously brought on Nick Cuse and Patrick Somerville, and like our favorite was Kath Lingenfelter last year. Do you pick certain people, and do you have like a tree of certain people that you'd like to choose from? How does that go down?
Well, it's an imperfect science. I mean, ultimately, it really the process starts with agents submit writers to the show, and so you just get stacks and stacks of scripts of potential candidates. And that stack is curated by Warner Brothers and HBO, who produce the show, and so they have writers that they've worked with that they think would be a good match for the culture of the show, not just in terms of like what the show is about, but also they know me and they know how I work, and so they'll say like, oh, I think you get along really well with this person. So I'll read those scripts, and then so my first response is to somebody's writing before I even lay eyes upon them as a human being. And when I respond to the writing, then we schedule an actual meeting with that person, and I sit down with them and hang out with them for an hour, and we talk about them, just as like, here's who I am and why I write and the kind of things that interest me as a writer. And then we talk about the show, and I get a sense of, you know, what aspects of the show they connect to. But mostly it's just sort of like, what's crazy about it is you're committing to someone based on an hour long meeting, and you're saying, okay, you're coming onto the staff, and I'm going to really depend on you right out of the gate. So, it's like a first date. It's just a gut instinct. Do I enjoy spending time with this person? And then I guess for me, it's different in every case, because when you're building a writing staff, you're trying to build complementary forces. And so if you've already got a writer who's like, I'm really interested in the kind of supernatural elements of the show or the religious elements of the show and what the show is saying about religion and faith and hucksterism, and the parts of the show that I really gravitate to are, you know, Holy Wayne and Kevin's dad hearing voices and all that stuff. You're like, okay, cool, we need that. But then you can't hire five writers who are all interested in that part of the show, because then you'll have no balance and the show will tip. So you're like, okay, I've already hired someone who's interested in that stuff. Now I want to hire someone who's basically like, I'm just like really interested in Nora. Like, I'm interested in how she's processing her loss. I'm interested in her job with the DSD. Guest was my favorite episode last year, and here's why, et cetera, et cetera. So you just try to kind of find complementary forces that are going to bounce off each other well. And then you try to the best of your ability to build some diversity in the room. That ranges from the age of someone to the color of their skin, to their gender, to their religious beliefs. I feel like if the entire room consisted of atheists, we'd be in trouble. So you have to kind of stack the deck with believers and non-believers. And my hope is like it's a lot like jury selection. I'm selecting a jury that I think is going to come to the most fair verdict, but I know that it's going to take a while to get there. Another element of it is like I really want to hire people who are not particularly impressed by me. That's not too hard to find, but I think that, you know, someone can be a fan of the show, but if it's like if they don't want to take me on, if they're afraid to say that's a pretty stupid idea, Damon, like it's not going to work out on the show. I need people who, you know, the show comes first, and I want the writer's room to be a safe place. Like, granted, you know, I am the de facto head writer, but for me, I do my best work when I feel like we're all buddies. I don't want to feel like I'm anyone's boss. So I need to hire people who are kind of like can hang out with me and you know, and treat me the same as that they would treat anybody else, and also are a little bit dark. You know, I mean, I'm drawn to people who are a little bit effed up, and a little bit angry and a little bit sad, all the things that the show is, you know, and what I am. It's hard for me to hang out with like genuinely happy people because they make me feel bad about not being happier myself.
So you and your writers, you obviously are famous for having things be a little bit ambiguous, which is what the show is and what it needs to be. A lot of people are trying to find answers to certain things, like why did Nora push the teacup off the table, or why did the dogs leave, or some things like that, specific things. But what I wanted to know from you is what are the broadest questions in terms of life that you think the viewers should be asking about your show? What are the things that are important to you that you think the viewers should be focusing on?
I don't want to tell anybody how to watch the show or what to focus on. I mean, I think that that's the beautiful thing about this show and about the content of the show, and maybe in many ways limits the show to, you know, tapping into a wider audience, because it doesn't tell you what the rules are in a way that other television shows that are much more comforting do. You know, I mean, if you're watching a cop show or a lawyer show or a doctor show, you kind of know exactly what you've signed up for. And I like that The Leftovers doesn't do that. But I think that it's pretty clear, not just from The Leftovers, but the storytelling that I'm attracted to, you know, going back to Lost and before, is I'm just really interested in this idea that we are given this life, you know, we're given life, and we're not given a rule book. There are people who are writing rule books, many different conflicting rule books as to what we're supposed to do with that life, but none of them can guarantee that their way is the right way. So we're all sort of kind of trying to figure it out on our own. And I think that storytelling that sort of simulates that same experience is really attractive to me. So, you know, you mentioned Nora, you know, tipping the cup over in season one, and is the audience supposed to be thinking, why did she do that? Yeah, if that's what you want to fixate on, I'm not going to tell you not to. Like, we have an intention as storytellers and why she did it, and Carrie Coon has an intention as an actress in terms of why she did it, and Jill and Amy, who watch her do it, are fascinated by the fact that she did it. But I think that we live in a world where people behave in really, really strange ways all the time, and we're scratching our heads, and it's hard for us to make sense of it. And I don't want to go to a dark place, but, you know, we live in a world where really bad things happen, like you know, like what happened in Paris or what happened in San Bernardino, and those things don't make sense to me. They just don't. Like, I don't want to live in a world where I go like, I get that. I get why someone takes a machine gun and walks into a concert where people show up to listen to music and just starts shooting, you know, indiscriminately murdering people. Like, I don't get it, but it still happens. And so, and ultimately it happens because people are, I believe, they're confused or they're angry or they're scared. And this isn't me sympathizing or empathizing with people who commit horrific acts, but I do feel like that energy is an energy that the leftovers taps into, and it makes people uncomfortable, but it's one that I'm very interested in as a writer. So everything that I want to say in terms of how the show should be watched is basically said in the new theme song. Iris Dement put it much more poetically and musically than I ever could, but it's a very blatant instruction as each episode starts to on how to watch the show. Because if you don't follow those instructions, I think the show is going to make you slightly pissed off.
Well, speaking of the theme song, you've talked a lot about subverting people's expectations, and you've succeeded in a lot of ways this year, be it the Cavewoman or International Assassin, singular point of views throughout the season or fluid point of views in the finale, and even the new song with the opening credits. Is it fair to say that you have a direction for season three that none of us are prepared for, like what happened in season two?
That's an awful big gauntlet to throw down. I think that, you know, what I'll say is in terms of my preliminary instincts about season three and that we've got to put those seeds in the ground and watch them grow and subject those ideas to the same process by which, season two, came to light, because again, it was a much different process in season one because we had Tom's book that we were adapting. And so there was this text that we could either conform to or aberrate from. But now, the kind of the sky's the limit. And the thing that I don't want to do is be gimmicky. You know, I think it's sort of like the minute that the audience is sort of like, oh, this show has to surprise me, or it takes huge risks. At a certain point, taking huge risks isn't risky anymore because the audience expects you to take them, and then they're not really risks anymore. So I feel like we want to build a story that is, you know, immensely satisfying and watchable, but it has the same basic ingredients that any episode or successful episode of The Leftovers should demonstrate, which is that you get inside the heads of these characters and you really care about them and invest in them. And, you know, that's all I'm really striving for. I'm oversimplifying a vastly complex thing, but it's like International Assassin is an episode that, you know, made a lot of waves, and we were really proud of when we finally cracked it. But the part of the episode that I am most gratified by is how emotional it is, given the fact that it's just ridiculously absurd. If you just say, here's the log line for this episode, but if you can also generate like a real emotional reaction and really understand Kevin better and Patty better and what their relationship was better in that absurdist construct, then the show is firing on all cylinders, because I don't want to just do crazy for crazy's sake.
Mm-hmm. So when you wrote International Assassin, did you know that you struck gold, or were you terrified that people just wouldn't get it?
If you ask anyone who knows me, I don't have the struck gold gene, you know, where it's like, I don't just like sit back and be like, wait till they get a load of this. You know, I mean, there's always a more overriding sense of fear dominating it. But I have gotten to a place where I'm like, if I feel like something is working, and I feel like it's good, the audience tends to agree with me. And if I feel like something isn't working, or, you know, or we've made profound mistakes, the audience tends to agree with me about that too. So I was kind of feeling like, there's a system by which we as writers came up with the idea for an International Assassin, and then we pitched it to Mimi, and then the actors read the script and HBO read the script. And so it had gone through enough sort of people's opinion spectrums for me to get a sense of like, okay, this works. But at the same time, we wrote that script, I think, before the audience had even seen the second or third episode of the show. So I had no idea how anybody was going to respond to anything. I think that, you know, the real terror was with the cave woman, where I was sort of like, this is going to be the litmus test for the entire season. If the audience goes with us after that first 10 minutes of the season, then we're going to have a very wide swath of stuff that we can get away with. But if they say, what the hell was that? Those pretentious bastards. I am never, ever watching The Leftovers again. Then International Assassin would have been a complete and utter disaster. So we got some validation on the premiere as we were writing International Assassin. And so I kind of felt like, oh, the audience kind of wants us to be a little bit crazy. as long as we earn it, we'll be okay.
So why is Purgatory in The Leftovers a hotel? And why do you feel like it was necessary to revisit it in the finale for Kevin?
Oh, man. implicit in your question is me confirming that the hotel is Purgatory. I feel like the less said about that, the better. I mean, I think that International Assassin is an episode that will be ultimately, I know that people are curious about it and I don't want to be standoffish, but the more that I talk about it, the less interesting the episode is. All I can say is that we went to great lengths and barked up a number of incorrect trees before we arrived at the conclusions that we did. But especially because, you know, International Assassin is the beginning of something, is the beginning of a story thread that is going to continue into the third season and the ultimate ending of the show. I feel like the less I talk about it, the better. I mean, I think that the more interesting question to be asking is, what does Kevin think that was? because he's not aware that he's on a television show and that the audience is speculating. But like, if you went through the experience that Kevin went through, you know, what's your takeaway from it? Mm-hmm. That feels like it's very rich, both territory for character and story.
Well, then let me ask it in this way then. you've dealt a lot with this kind of world or this kind of scenario in your writing. I mean, we all know The Flash, Sideways, and Lost, and obviously The Hotel in The Leftovers. So what about that storytelling is compelling to you?
I mean, I think that the short answer to the question is pretty simple, which is I'm really interested in what happens to people when they die. Mm-hmm. And not just as a purely religious pursuit, but also a scientific pursuit and a philosophical pursuit, which is, your answer to that question, what do you think is going to happen to you when you die, is really going to govern the way that you live. So it's not that I'm morbidly obsessed with death, but I think like a show like 6 Feet Under I loved it so much and was so fascinating to me, is that it really dealt with the issue of fundamental mortality. But I think that The Leftovers is more interested in the spiritual ramifications of that question, because Tom set up an idea, the meta idea of the show being the sudden departure. It's a big death metaphor. It's loss. And so we have a definition for death, which is, oh, so we know what that is. And if somebody dies, we know what to do. We bury their body and we have a funeral. And not everybody has different ways of doing it, all different cultures. But there's a process sort of attached to it. And there was no process attached to the sudden departure. Like, what do we call this? Are we ever going to see these people again? Where did they go? Did they go anywhere? And so it just became completely and totally fascinating to me, especially knowing that the show is never going to answer that question, how people would react. And so the idea of a quote unquote afterlife feels like it's very much in tune with The Leftovers. I think that people grafted the afterlife idea onto Lost right out of the gate, because it was in the DNA of the show that, you know, characters started articulating very early on. We all died in that plane crash, and this is an opportunity to start over with a clean slate. they were speaking metaphorically, of course, but the audience was using the purgatory word very, very early on before the show itself even started to float those ideas. And I think the reason for that is that we're very curious, you know, as human beings, everybody's curious. I've yet to meet a person who's like, I'm not curious about what happens when you die, just not even curious about it. And some people, you know, there are a lot of people that I've run into who are 100% certain that they know what happens when they die, but none of those people tend to agree with one another. And that's pretty fascinating to me. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's sort of the one question that I feel like we will never have an answer to. So it's pretty cool to write stories about.
And it's pretty cool to podcast about, let me tell you. As you can tell, I'm a very like upbeat, happy person. People keep telling me I'm like a Christmas elf because I'm just so chipper and happy. And talking about this show and talking about, you know, death or what I might think happens after I die or all these kind of different questions that you've had within your writing has been awesome. It's mm-hmm. just been so fun to not only watch, but then to imagine on our own. So I want to thank you and all of the writers.
Well, I really appreciate that, and I will pass that on. And you should know if I were writing a show about Christmas elves, they would be complaining about the hours and how they aren't appreciated, and that they're kind of scared of Santa. But most importantly, like they kind of don't really know what to do for the 10 months of the year between January and Thanksgiving. So it's nice. It's nice that particularly because we're in the season, you found the bright side of elfdom. But I think that it could probably be a pretty lonely experience, and I don't like the cold either.
Well, we live in Rhode Island, so we are usually covered in white cold stuff. So,
you'd be a good elf.
I know. I've got it somewhere within me. Well, speaking of this Christmas elves pitch, everyone pitches ideas in the writing room, I imagine, some serious and some not. So what was your favorite joke pitch that ended up becoming serious and making its way into the show?
I mean, I don't know if there was ever like a joke pitch, but there are many pitches that start out, you know, ridiculous, and then suddenly become, there's something really, really interesting there. International Assassin was one of those pitches, and then when we were breaking the finale. And we were talking about the idea that Kevin was going to be killed again. He's going to be shot by John Murphy, and he was going to return to the space. Everybody loved that idea, but then it was like, how does he get out? I mean, we made it so hard for him to get out the first time. We committed like an entire episode to it. Now we've kind of got to do like a bite-sized version of International Assassin in like 7 minutes. Like, it shouldn't be easy for him to get out, and it needs to be emotional too, like or else we risk undoing everything that episode 8 did for us. And then Parada, without really, you know, I mean, it's not like we were puzzling over this for hours, like almost right out of the gate, Parada just said he should sing his way out. Like they should be like a bunch of drunk people down at the bar doing karaoke, and Kevin has to get up there and sing. And we all kind of looked at him like, that's the stupidest thing that I've ever heard. And like right on the heels of that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard, that's the greatest thing that I've ever heard. And then we were doing it. And then the next 2 hours became everybody pitching what song should Kevin be singing. And listening to those songs. Haley, our writer's assistant, would pull them up for us. There was a very... Haley was the one who, in fact, pitched, like, it has to be Like a Prayer. Madonna's Like a Prayer. And we all completely and totally locked in on that idea. And we, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, couldn't clear it. And Homeward Bound was a close, was the runner-up. And I can't imagine it having been anything other than that now. But that was certainly an instance of, you're not serious. I hope you are serious because that's great.
I want to know how you keep track of all your thoughts. If you're just walking around, I was at Panera the other day and I said, how does Damon like just come up with his ideas and then make sure he doesn't forget them? Do you have like an app or do you have like a little notebook? Because I assume they must come to you in the most funny places, I assume.
I love that you were thinking about that at Panera. I don't even want to know what was happening at Panera. This podcast brought to you by Panera. Yeah. I guess this is the way that I very rarely write things down or record audio. My feeling is that if it is an idea that is worthy, it will stick. Like, I've never had a circumstance where I'm like, oh my God, I had the greatest idea this morning and I just can't remember it. If that's true, then it was not as great as I thought it was in the time that I was having it. When I have an idea that infects me, it just doesn't leave my brain. It becomes like, oh my God, I can't wait to get this out of my head. And for the leftovers is like, there's very rarely time where I'm not engaging on the show in some way or able to articulate to someone else, oh, I just had this really cool idea. So I'm not, I very rarely write down or jot down ideas. I feel like my brain is good at retaining the ideas that are worth retaining, and it is good at deleting the ideas that are worth deleting.
So in season one, Kevin's sleepwalking became a serious issue by season's end, and since he couldn't account for the missing time and his actions during it. And in season two, Kevin battled both sleepwalking and Patty in a metaphysical kind of form. So do you feel the show operates at its best with Kevin fighting for his sanity, and do you see that trend continuing in season three?
I feel like, again, season three is still very, very nascent, and I don't want to say this is what it's going to be or this is what it's not going to be. But what I will say is I'm not particularly interested in continuing to revisit the "is Kevin crazy" idea. Mm-hmm. You know, in terms of, unless we can find a different permutation of it, I feel like we really explored that idea in depth this season and next season, especially because it's the final season of the series, trying to find something new that is not new, but just for the arbitrary sake of being new, but it's like it's the next step in the evolution of that idea. Mm-hmm. Kevin now has to decide. I think "Am I crazy?" was the "Where is my mind?" was the question of this season, quite literally. I mean, I beat people about this. Like, do you get it? We'll just play the song again. But now, moving into the next year, Kevin, I'd be much more interested in writing to Kevin who's decided that he's not crazy, or that he is crazy and that he acts accordingly. But I kind of feel like in episode 7, Lori presents him with the two doors, and she's like, behind door number one is "you're psychotic, and there is no Patty, and you are, you know, you have some very serious emotional issues, and you need to institutionalize yourself and get on medication immediately." And behind door number two is Virgil, who says that you are possessed by a dark entity, and you need to rid yourself of it by dying. Hmm. So Kevin makes a decision, and I would rather follow that Kevin through the remainder of the series. The one, you know, the decisive. I'm deciding that I'm not crazy. This isn't to say that he isn't, but for him to be continuing to question his own sanity, I think, both as a writer and certainly my understanding of what the audience would want, is kind of like, oh God, it's like watching The Incredible Hulk, where you just want Banner to get over, like, dude, you're the Hulk. Just like, you know, just be the Hulk. Like, we know you're never going to find a cure, because I don't want to watch the show where you're cured of being the Hulk. First off, you have to change the name. Like, but I kind of feel like the more interesting show at this point is that we're no longer, we're done with, the sleepwalking was a manifestation of Kevin's inability to come to terms with all of the, you know, trauma that he was dealing with, both prior to the departure and post-departure, and his unwillingness to acknowledge that this massive life-changing event, a spiritual event, had occurred, resulting in the loss of 140 million individuals. He just didn't even want to acknowledge it. Now he's acknowledging it, and I feel like as a reward, he doesn't have to sleepwalk and have weird and off-putting dream sequences anymore. We're past that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we want to thank you so incredibly much for taking the time out of your very busy schedule. This was an absolute delight to have you on and to be able to talk about all these questions that have been burning in our minds for so long. Thank you so much, Damon.
It's my pleasure, guys. Thanks again for all your loving attention to the show and to everybody who listens to the podcast. I know that, again, as creators and showrunners or whatever what have you, it's we're supposed to say, well, we just do it for the fans and we love the fans, but that's true when people say it. But in my case, like, as a fan of TV and movies and books and comics and all that stuff, like, there's that's the community whose validation and appreciation means the most to me. And so I'm just enormously grateful, and I really feel like we're going to get to do a third season of the show because of the support of people like yourselves and people who listen to the pod who, like, really go deep on the show. Mm-hmm. There's so much stuff out there to consume your time, and now so much great stuff. So the fact that people take the time to even watch The Leftovers, let alone listen to a podcast about it or make a podcast about it, it's just like it's the greatest thing ever. So I speak for the entire team behind the show when I express my gratitude.
Yay!
Wow, unbelievable.
I can't believe I told him I was a Christmas elf.
That happened.
Hi, Damon Lindelof, like one of the most important people in our lives right now. Guess what?
I'm a Christmas elf.
What is wrong with me? Word vomit.
The thing I was really impressed about was how self-deprecating he was in a lot of ways. And I think he's famous for that, obviously. And he's always willing to see what he... And make fun of himself, make fun of his work, and he's always readily available to do that. And I think... it's one of the ways that he likes to deal with people, because he doesn't, like he says, he doesn't want people to think that he's this Oz type figure, you know, that you can't challenge him. You can't say, Damon, that's a stupid choice. Don't do that. And I love that little revelation that he had about how he picks his writers. They can't be impressed by him in any sense of the word. They have to challenge him, right? What a great introduction to how he works his room. Because, you know, you often feel like these guys, powerhouse showrunners like Ron Moore or Damon Lindelof or David Chase or Brian Fuller, you think like these guys are experts and they know exactly what they're doing. And of course, they do. But you also have the feeling like you can't challenge him. You know, it's like challenging Bill Belichick in football. You can't do that because the guy knows everything. It's also like challenging George Lucas with Star Wars. You can't do that because the guy created the universe. I'm sorry, you just can't. So it's great to hear that he is responsible to not only himself, but to the writers as well. And how about that bomb he dropped about the hotel?
Oh my God.
Revisiting it potentially in season 3.
That is really cool. Now, you, of course, read things, you know, Leftovers chat wise. Mm-hmm. I try to steer clear so that my own genius ideas can fully be mine. we all know how some of those turn out. Not so swell. But how cool.
The aliens.
So you said you hadn't have heard that or read it. Exactly. Aliens being one of them.
I know. No, I had not heard any of that. I think that is something that is a little known fact. So the fact that the fact that we got that on this podcast is a huge honor. And I just wanted to say thank you to Damon Lindelof again for coming on and spending a lot of time with us, a lot more time than we actually had allotted. He was very generous with what he was giving us, not only information and everything, but his time as well. He's extremely, extremely busy. So knowing that he was able to talk with us for this long was a real pleasure. And speaking of Damon and the bomb that he dropped that we mentioned earlier in this show, that International Assassin and the hotel that was in it may be revisited in season 3. You know, you may want to, when season 3 comes about, actually revisit season 2 to get all the nuances that we talked about with Damon and get back to what that world is, so that when we do get to season three, you're fresh, man. I mean, if you're listening to this interview and you don't have HBO, I mean, well, honestly, who doesn't have HBO? You're missing out on like the best TV ever. But if you don't have it, you should get HBO now. You know, you only pay a certain amount of money per month and you're getting everything that HBO offers now and actually has ever offered, like every single like show they've ever offered, whether it was like Rome or whatever, like, you know, really cool Sopranos, every single episode they've ever put out of their own television, The Wire, it's all there. So I would totally recommend that. And HBO Go too, you can always catch up on that stuff as well. And there are a couple of other people that I want to thank. Specifically, Brian Davids of Film Schlubs podcast. He and I and Mary, we all went over these questions for hours and hours and hours on end, and he helped craft them and make them as best as possible within the time frame that we had. So thank you to Brian Davids of the Film Schlubs podcast. Check him out. He actually has a segment on our podcast called the Brian Davids Thought of the Week. He also covers The Leftovers on his own podcast as well. But I also wanted to thank the writers on the Living Reminders blog, Missy being the editor in chief, Kendra, Denise, Mike, John, Ashley, Russell, Franziska, Chris, all you guys. When we found out that we were interviewing Damon, we put out an SOS and we said, please, we need help, because I was literally intellectually paralyzed when I found out that this was going to happen. And so I wanted to thank all of you guys. This would not have happened without you. And also, if you go to the Living Reminders blog, you will be able to find the transcription of this entire interview as soon as you go there. So you'll be able to read everything that you've just heard in case you missed anything. So I just want to let you know about the Living Reminders blog. We'll have this interview as well.
Yes, they will. So if you just want to read it, want to revisit it, do it.
Yeah.
Do it up.
And
all right.
You know, actually, I do want to thank Aaron and Angela as well. You guys also helped make this happen. It was a dream come true, like we've said at the beginning of the show, and it wouldn't have been possible without you. So thank you. You know who you are, and I really, really, really appreciate it. So, my love, are you ready to close out this surreal and totally cool episode of The Living Reminders?
Yeah.
All right. Let's do it.
Keep this conversation going about The Leftovers. Let's hear your theories. What do you want to see in season three? Or just say hi to me and Blake. You know, you guys are our family. Reach out to us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. You can find us by searching Living Reminders.
And if the social media isn't enough for you and you want to tell us how badly or how great we did in this interview, you can always reach us at livingreminders@gmail.com.
Head on over to our website, thelivingreminders.com, for all of our previous episodes, our interviews, and all kinds of fun things.
That's right. And while you're at the website, you can click on this little button that says support. And there are a bunch of different ways that you can support us, the Living Reminders, in helping us keep this a free podcast. One of them is if you can go to Patreon, you can donate a dollar or two. Or if you want to do a one-time payment or donation because you don't want the monthly commitment, you can go to PayPal and make a one-time donation. But you know, the money's important, whatever. I mean, that is what it is. But the most important thing you can do, the one thing I really want you to do, is tell a friend that we exist. Tell a friend on Facebook or Twitter or whatever you do, and tell them that The Leftovers exists. Because it's a show that needs attention, and we would love the publicity. So please, tell everybody that we exist.
Head on over to iTunes and Stitcher, and please leave us a rating or a review. Those of you who've taken the time to write us a review, don't forget we want to send you a holiday card to thank you so much for taking the time to write a couple of sentences about us. So if you have done it, or if you're going to, write us an email and let us know your mailing address so we can snail mail you some loving from Blake and myself.
That's right. And the last but certainly not least thing I want you to do is to check out the Living Reminders blog. It is written by the fans, for the fans. It all takes place, and you'll be able to find this very interview, as a matter of fact, again, transcribed on the blog, in addition to all the great ideas and theories and analysis that you guys, the fans, are on our staff, that you actually do. And it provides you a voice and helps, again, provide value for you in this Leftovers universe.
Happy holidays, everyone. Blake and I wish you and your families and your loved ones many warm wishes.
That's right.
Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Mary Larson.
My name's Blake.
And we're still here.